I want you to picture a sound. It's a sound that nobody ever really wants to hear, but if you work in emergency medicine, it's basically the soundtrack of your day.
It's that high-pitched, rhythmic beeping of the monitors, but all out of sync. It's a kind of organized chaos.
It is. And you've got the squeak of stretcher wheels on linoleum, the urgent but controlled voices, and then the heavy, ragged breathing of a patient who has just, lost complete control of their own body.
You're in the ER, the doors fly open, paramedics are shouting handoff reports, the patient is post-ictal, meaning they're coming out of a seizure.
Exactly. And in this case, let's say it's a young man, maybe in his mid-20s. He's just had a generalized convulsive seizure, a GCS. He's confused, maybe a little combative, or maybe just completely out of it. And the team just swarms him.
First things first,
Yeah.
airway, breathing, circulation,
Yeah.
the ABCs, you have to stabilize them.
Right. And as soon as that's underway, the needles come out.
Standard procedure. You have to draw blood immediately. You have absolutely no idea why this person seized.
Could be anything.
Is it low blood sugar? An electrolyte imbalance that's gone haywire? Or, and this is the big scary one, is it an infection?
That's the one that keeps you up at night. Is this meningitis? Is this sepsis? Is there some bacteria causing the brain to swell? So the tubes of blood are whisked away to the lab, and the clock starts ticking.
And you're waiting. It's probably the longest 45 minutes of your shift.
Then the results ping on the computer screen, and the ER doctor's heart just sinks. The white blood cell count, the leukocytes, is sky high.
And we're not talking about a little bump here. We're talking numbers that basically scream catastrophe.
Like, what kind of numbers are we talking
A
about?
normal count might top out around 11,000. You might see a 20,000, maybe a 25,000. In any medical textbook, that number usually means one thing. The body is at war,
An invasion.
a full-blown bacterial invasion. So the whole machine kicks into gear. They start what's called the infection protocol or the infectious workup.
Which involves what exactly?
It's everything. You're looking for the source. So a chest X-ray to look for pneumonia, you're drawing cultures, and the big one, a lumbar puncture, a spinal tap to see if there's bacteria in the fluid around the brain and spinal cord.
And while you're waiting for those results, you're pumping them full of heavy-duty, broad-spectrum antibiotics through an IV. You can't afford to wait.
You have to assume the worst. But here is the twist, and it's the mystery we are going to try and solve today.
There is no bug.
There's no bug. They scan everything. The lungs are clear. The spinal fluid is crystal clear. The urine is clean. There is no infection anywhere.
And then maybe 12, 24 hours later, poof, the white blood cell count just drops all on its own. It goes right back down to normal, like it never happened.
It's a phantom infection. A biological false alarm that sends the entire medical system on this wild goose chase.
And for over 100 years, this whole phenomenon has been written off as just a quirk of epilepsy. Oh, that's just a post-seizure thing. Don't worry about it. But the paper we are diving into today argues that we have been dead wrong about that. Dangerously wrong.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating review from Frontiers in Neurology. It's titled Hiding in Plain Sight, a Review of Post-Convulsive Leukocyte Elevations. And the authors, Vega, Komisurik, and Stewart, are basically saying we've misunderstood a critical clue for over a century.
They're arguing this isn't a false alarm at all. It's a message.
It's a message. They argue that this supposedly useless spike in white blood cells is actually a biological black box recorder. It's telling us a story about what just happened inside the patient's body.
A story about how violent the seizure was, not just for the muscles, but specifically for the lungs.
Exactly. And their big idea is that if we finally learn how to read this message, it might be a life-saving clue. A warning sign for the biggest killer in epilepsy, SUDEP.
Sudden unexpected death in epilepsy.
Right. So this isn't just medical trivia. This is a detective story. It spans 120 years. It involves some pretty bizarre experiments, serendipity, adrenaline, and the hidden mechanics of our own lungs.
A detective story. I like that. So where do we start? Like all good detective stories, we have to go back to the scene of the crime. But the scene isn't a modern, shiny hospital.
No, we have to go way back. Before MRIs, before EEGs as we know them, before genetic testing, we're going back to the era of gaslight and glass slides.
We're talking 1896, Boston, Massachusetts.
That's awesome.
And we are at McLean Hospital, which at the time was, for all intents and purposes, a psychiatric asylum.
Right. And our detective, our main character, is a young, probably very tired house officer named Joseph Capps.
A house officer sounds like a resident today, right? You live at the hospital, you do all the grunt work.
Pretty much. And Capps had an interest in hematology, the study of blood. Now, you have to remember, drawing blood back then was not the quick little vacutainer stick it is today. It was a whole ordeal. You had glass pipettes, lancets. It was much more invasive.
And Caps has a schedule. He's a methodical guy. He's supposed to draw blood from a specific patient at a specific time for some ongoing study.
Yeah.
But epilepsy doesn't really care about your schedule.
Not at all. Mm. And just as Caps is prepping his equipment, you know, cleaning his glass slides, maybe sharpening his lancet, his patient goes into a massive tonic-clonic seizure. Right in front of him.
So what does he do? I mean, my instinct would be to drop everything and just help the patient.
And he likely did. But most doctors at the time would have just stopped the experiment.
Hmm.
You know, you stabilize the patient, you wait for them to recover, maybe you come back tomorrow. But Caps.
Yeah.
Caps sees an opportunity.
A scientific opportunity.
A moment of pure serendipity. He decides, you know what? I'm going to draw the blood now. Immediately. Right there. While the patient is arguably still in the throes of the event or just seconds out of it.
That feels, I don't know, a little intense.
It's scientific curiosity, completely overriding convention. He gets the sample, he rushes it to his microscope.
Yeah.
And remember, he has to count these cells by hand with a little clicker staring down a lens. It's painstaking work.
And he looks through the eyepiece and sees what?
A snowstorm.
Yeah.
The slide is just littered with white blood cells. He sees what he calls a marked leukocytosis, a huge spike.
But Caps knows this patient. He knows there's no fever, no cough, no sign of pneumonia.
Right. So he has this radical thought, a thought that no one had really proven before. What if it wasn't an infection? What if the seizure itself caused this flood of cells to appear?
Okay, but that's a huge leap. Correlation doesn't equal causation. He can't just publish one weird case study. They'd laugh him out of the room. He needs proof.
Needs proof. So he designs an experiment that honestly just sounds exhausting to even describe. He identifies a group of patients with severe epilepsy, and he decides he needs to monitor their blood around the clock.
When you say around the clock, what do you mean?
I mean he was drawing their blood every 4 hours, day and night.
Wow.
He had to. He needed to establish a baseline for each patient. He needed to know what their blood looked like during peacetime so that if or when a seizure happened, he'd have something to compare it to.
I can't imagine being Caps, setting an alarm for 3 a.m. to go stick a needle in someone, or being the patient who has to agree to this.
It shows incredible dedication on all sides, but it paid off. He was there when the seizures happened. He managed to get the before sample and the immediate after sample, and the data was just undeniable.
What did he find?
He concluded a few things. First, the spike is definitely induced by the convulsion itself. Second, it's sudden and pronounced. It happens within minutes. But here's the third thing he noticed, and this becomes absolutely crucial for our deep dive today.
Okay.
He didn't just see a spike. He saw a pattern in the size of the spike.
What kind of pattern?
Caps noted in his 1896 paper that the degree of the leukocytosis, the height of the spike, seemed to correlate with the length and severity of the attack.
So a little seizure, a little bump in the white count, a massive prolonged convulsion.
A massive, terrifying spike in the white count.
So in 1896, Joseph Caps basically hands the medical world a roadmap. He says, look, seizures cause these white blood cell spikes. It's mechanical, not infectious. And it seems to act as a kind of biological severity meter.
He lays it all out. And then, for the next century, medicine sort of forgot about it. Or maybe not forgot, but misinterpreted it. We focused on the what, and we completely ignored the why.
It just became this annoying false positive. Oh, the count is high, but he just had a seizure, so just ignore it.
Exactly. A clinical nuisance. And to understand the why, the mechanism behind the spike, we actually have to leave Caps in Boston. We have to cross the Atlantic and jump back in time a few years to 1893.
Where are we going?
We're going to England. And we're going to meet a doctor who had a very strange definition of family dinner.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
The man's name was Dr. George Oliver. And Oliver was a physician who was really interested in endocrinology and glands. He was making these glycerin extracts from the adrenal glands of sheep and calves.
Okay, still with you. He's making adrenal gland juice.
Pretty much. And he wanted to know what this extract did to the human body. He needed a test subject. So he fed it to his own son.
He did what?
He fed the extract to his son.
Wow. Okay. I feel like there are several ethics boards today that would like to have a long talk with Dr. Oliver.
Oh, absolutely. It was a very different time for medical research.
Mm-hmm.
But he did it. He fed the stuff to his son, and then he took out his instruments and measured his son's pulse and the diameter of the radial artery in his wrist.
And what did he say?
An immediate dramatic reaction. The arteries clamped down, they constricted, and the pulse just started racing.
he had discovered an incredibly potent vasoconstrictor, something that squeezes blood vessels.
Exactly. He knows he's onto something huge, so he rushes to University College London to meet with a very famous physiologist, a guy named Edward Schaefer. Together, they refine the experiment, they inject it into animals, they confirm the effect.
And this work eventually leads to the isolation and discovery of one of the most famous molecules in all of biology.
Adrenaline, or as it's also known, epinephrine.
Okay, so how does this bizarre father-son experiment in England connect back to our seizure patient in Boston?
The connection comes a little bit later, with the work of another giant in physiology, Walter Bradford Cannon at Harvard.
Okay.
Cannon is the one who gives us the whole context. He's the guy who coins the phrase fight or flight.
Survival response.
Right. He figures out that when an animal or a human is terrified or enraged or even asphyxiating, the body dumps this chemical adrenaline from the adrenal glands into the bloodstream.
It's the body's override switch for survival.
It is. It instantly reroutes your entire physiology. It shunts blood away from your stomach, you know, who needs to digest lunch when you're being chased by a tiger, and pumps it to the big skeletal muscles, the heart, the lungs, and the brain. Everything you need to either fight for your life or run for your life.
But Cannon and his colleagues noticed something else, didn't they? Something in the blood.
They did. They found that when you artificially inject an animal with adrenaline, or when you subject it to extreme fear or rage, its white blood cell count skyrockets.
So we have these two completely parallel lines of evidence developing at the same time. On one side, CAPS in Boston is seeing massive white cell spikes after a physical seizure.
And on the other side, Cannon in Cambridge is seeing massive white cell spikes after a chemical surge of adrenaline.
And since a generalized convulsive seizure is basically the biggest, most violent adrenaline dump a human body can possibly experience,
the connection is finally made. The seizure triggers the fight or flight response. The body dumps adrenaline. And that adrenaline somehow triggers this massive spike in white blood cells.
Okay, I think I buy that. The chemistry makes sense. Seizure causes adrenaline. Adrenaline causes the spike. But I'm still stuck on the physics of it. You said earlier this happens in minutes.
Right. Very fast.
If I get a real infection, my bone marrow has to get a signal, and then it has to manufacture millions of new white blood cells. That takes hours, if not days. How does the body conjure up 15,000 new cells in 10 minutes?
That's the million-dollar question. And the simple answer is, it doesn't.
It doesn't make them.
It doesn't make them. You cannot manufacture cells that fast. They aren't new cells. They were already there.
Hiding.
Hiding. Hiding in plain sight.
Okay. This feels like where the story really gets interesting. This brings us to the core mechanics of the spike. You called it the traffic jam in the lungs?
Yeah, this concept to me is one of the coolest things in physiology. We have this tendency to think of our blood as like a homogeneous soup. You know, you take a drop from your finger, and it should be the same as a drop from your heart or your brain. But that's just not true.
The paper we're looking at talks about this concept of the marginated pool. It sounds like a relaxing vacation spot, but I have a feeling it's not.
Definitely not.
I mean it.
So think about your lungs. On a microscopic level, they are made up of millions of tiny air sacs called alveoli. And wrapped around each of those sacs is a web of incredibly tiny blood vessels called alveolar capillaries.
That's where the magic happens, right? Where the oxygen from the air you breathe gets swapped into the blood.
That's the spot. Now, these tubes, these capillaries, are microscopic. They are so narrow that red blood cells have to pass through them in single file. Now, think about the different types of cells trying to get through this tiny network. You've got your red blood cells, which are like the small, fast delivery trucks for oxygen.
Okay.
And then you have your white blood cells, specifically a type called polymorphonucleocytes, or PMNs, which are mostly neutrophils. These are the soldiers of your immune system.
And I'm guessing the soldiers are not the same size as the delivery trucks.
Not even close. The soldiers, the neutrophils, are significantly larger than the red blood cells. And maybe more importantly, they are much more rigid. A red blood cell is like a flexible little frisbee. It can fold in half to squeeze through a tight spot. A white blood cell is more like a sticky tennis ball.
So you're trying to push a sticky tennis ball through a pipe that was designed for a frisbee?
Exactly. It's a fundamental size mismatch problem. So what happens? There's a traffic jam. It's just simple physics.
The red blood cells just zip past them.
They zip past. The paper cites data that red blood cells travel through the lung capillaries 60 to 100 times faster than the leukocytes do. The white blood cells have to deform. They have to change from spheres into these long ellipsoid shapes just to squeeze through. So they crawl slowly along the vessel walls Or they just stop moving entirely for a period of time.
They get marginated.
They're parked on the shoulder of the highway, letting all the fast traffic go by.
And is this just a few cells here and there?
No, this is what's so mind-blowing. At any given moment, the paper suggests that 55 to 60% of all the neutrophils in your entire body's blood supply are parked or marginated in your lungs.
Wait, more than half of my white blood cells are just hanging out in my lungs, not circulating.
Yes. In fact, the total number of white blood cells in this marginated pool in your lungs is larger than the number of white blood cells actively circulating the rest of your body combined.
That's incredible. So when a doctor draws blood from your arm to do a CBC, a complete blood count, they're only measuring the circulating pool.
Correct. You're only counting the cars that are actually moving on the highway. You have no idea how many are parked in the massive, invisible parking garage of the lungs.
It's hiding in plain sight, just like the title of the paper says.
It is. The reserve army is waiting right there.
Okay, so let's connect this back to this seizure. The patient has a seizure. Adrenaline floods their system. Their heart rate spikes. We call that tachycardia. What happens to that giant parking garage in the lungs?
The garage door is blown off its hinges. The massive surge of adrenaline causes the heart to contract with incredible force and speed. This dramatically increases the cardiac output, the amount of blood being pumped.
So the speed of the blood flowing through the lungs just skyrockets.
It skyrockets. And this creates what physicists call shear force.
It's like turning a garden hose into a fire hose.
A perfect analogy. It's like a flash flood rushing through a narrow canyon. And that sheer physical force of the fast-moving blood literally rips those parked, marginated white blood cells off the walls of the capillaries. It physically sweeps them out of the parking garage and into the main circulation.
So it's a mechanical process. It's not a chemical signal telling them to deploy. It's just the force of the blood.
It's primarily the force. But adrenaline does a couple of other clever things, too, that the authors detail beautifully in the paper. It's not just about the speed of the river.
What else does it do?
Adrenaline actually has a direct effect on the white blood cells themselves. It binds to receptors on their surface and triggers a change in their internal scaffolding, what's called the cytoskeleton.
The cytoskeleton is what gives the cell its shape and rigidity, right?
Exactly. And adrenaline causes that internal scaffolding to relax a little bit. It softens the cell.
So our sticky tennis ball becomes more like a squishy water balloon.
A much better analogy. It can deform and squeeze through tight spaces much more easily. And that's not all. Adrenaline also hinders the adhesion molecules on the cell's surface. It basically makes them less sticky.
So you have a perfect storm. The cells themselves become slipperier and squishier. And at the exact same moment, the river they're in turns into a raging torrent.
Precisely. The slippery, squishy cells get blasted out of the lungs by this massive shear force. And boom, they all flood into the general circulation.
And suddenly that blood draw from the patient's arm, which is, you know, miles away from the lungs in physiological terms, shows this massive, inexplicable spike.
It's not an infection. It's a relocation program. It's a rapid mechanical redistribution of the body's existing assets.
This distinction is so important. The paper also brings up cortisol. I usually hear about cortisol and adrenaline together, you know, as the stress hormones. Does cortisol play a role here?
It does play a role in stress, but it's a completely different time scale. I like to think of it this way. Adrenaline is the emergency text message. Cortisol is the formal letter that arrives in the mail a few days later.
Wow.
Adrenaline works in seconds to minutes. That's what drives this immediate demargination from the lungs that we just talked about. Cortisol is the slow stress hormone. Its effects take hours to build. And interestingly, it works by a different mechanism. Cortisol tells the bone marrow to release more cells, not the lungs.
So if an ER doctor sees a huge spike in white blood cells 20 minutes after a seizure, that is almost certainly not cortisol.
It's not. It is 100% adrenaline-driven, shear force-mediated demargination from the pulmonary vascular bed. The paper is very clear that cortisol release after seizures is inconsistent and way too slow to explain the immediate spike that confuses everyone in the ER.
Okay, so the mechanism seems pretty solid. Big seizure equals big adrenaline rush, which equals big shear force in the lungs, which equals big spike in the white count. It seems so logical, but science is never that clean, is it? There's been a debate about this for 100 years.
Oh, a huge debate. Yeah. A century-long controversy, really. And it all goes back to Capps's original claim that the size of the spike correlates correlates with the severity of the seizure.
Why would that be controversial? It seems to follow from the mechanism. A bigger seizure should mean a bigger adrenaline surge and more sheer force.
It should. But people stopped looking as closely or as carefully as Capps did. About 20 years after his paper, another researcher in Philadelphia published a study saying essentially, I tried to replicate this, and I found no relationship whatsoever between seizure severity and the cell count.
And that just muddied the waters for decades.
For decades. More recent studies, especially some pediatric studies looking at kids with febrile seizures, also failed to find a clear association. So a lot of doctors just concluded, well, it's random, it happens, but the size of the spike doesn't mean anything.
So why the discrepancy? Why did Capps see it so clearly and others didn't?
The devil, as always, is in the details. And the biggest detail here is timing. The half-life of adrenaline in the bloodstream is incredibly short. We're talking a couple of minutes. Once the seizure stops, the adrenaline gets metabolized, the heart rate slows down, the sheer force in the lungs drops. And what do you think those white blood cells do?
They go right back to the parking lot.
They go right back. They remarginate. So if you wait an hour or 2 hours to draw the blood after the seizure,
you've completely missed the show. The evidence is gone.
You've missed it. The tide has already gone out. And the authors of this review point out that many of the modern studies that failed to find a correlation simply weren't controlling for the time of the blood draw. They were drawing blood whenever it was convenient, long after the peak physiological event had passed.
But what about the studies where they do control the timing?
That's where it gets really interesting. When you look at studies done in specialized epilepsy monitoring units, EMUs, the results are completely different.
These are the places where patients are in the hospital for days, hooked up to an EEG 247, trying to capture a seizure on camera.
Exactly. So you have a nurse right there, ready to go. The second the seizure ends, they can draw the blood. We're talking within 5 to 10 minutes. And in those studies, the correlation comes roaring back.
Capps was right all along.
He was right. When you control for time, a more severe seizure absolutely correlates with a higher leukocyte spike.
Hey, there was another issue too, wasn't there, about how different studies define a severe seizure.
Correct. This is a classic problem in medical research. Some of the studies that found no link had an exclusion criterion. They deliberately excluded patients with status epilepticus.
And status epilepticus is?
It's the most severe, life-threatening type of seizure. It's when a seizure lasts too long or when seizures happen back-to-back without the person recovering in between. It's a massive medical emergency.
So if you're trying to see if severity correlates with a biomarker and you deliberately throw out all the most severe cases from your data set,
you're going to blunt your results. You're cutting off the top end of the spectrum, which is exactly where you'd expect to see the strongest effect.
This all brings up a really practical application of this knowledge that doctors can use right now. We talked about how this spike can look like a fake infection, but it can also help distinguish from another kind of fake seizure.
Right. We're talking about PNES, psychogenic non-epileptic seizures.
We should be careful with the language here because these are very real events for the patient.
Absolutely. The experience is real, but the underlying cause is different. PNES events can look almost identical to an epileptic seizure shaking, unresponsiveness, convulsions, but they're not caused by the abnormal synchronized electrical firing in the brain that defines epilepsy. They're typically triggered by psychological stress or trauma.
And making that diagnosis can be incredibly difficult, especially in a chaotic ER setting.
It's one of the toughest diagnostic challenges in neurology. But this white blood cell count can be a powerful tool. Because generally speaking, a PNES event does not generate that massive, life or death, physiological catecholamine surge that a generalized tonic-clonic seizure does.
The body's fight or flight system isn't activated in the same way.
Not to the same degree. So if a patient comes in after convulsing for 5 minutes and you draw their blood immediately and their white blood cell count hasn't budged from their baseline.
That's a strong piece of evidence suggesting it might have been a non-epileptic event.
A very strong piece. In fact, the paper mentions a specific calculation that some researchers have developed. It combines the leukocyte count with another blood value called the Inyan gap, which measures the buildup of lactic acid in the blood from intense muscle exertion.
And using that equation,
you can predict with about 90% probability whether a seizure was epileptic or psychogenic. That's a huge diagnostic aid when you're trying to figure out how to treat the patient right in front of you.
It really is. But there's a trap here, and the authors make a point to warn us about it. It's what you could call the normal range track. I think anyone who's ever looked at their own blood test results has fallen for this.
Oh, absolutely. The green zone trend.
Yeah. You get your lab report back and you just scan down that column on the right. Oh. If your number is between, say, 4,000 and 11,000 for white blood cells, it gets marked normal. Mm-hmm. And you stop thinking about it.
You see green, your brain turns off. But the authors argue this is a really dangerous way of thinking in this specific context.
How so?
Okay, let's take an example. Let's say your personal healthy baseline white blood cell count is 4,000. That's on the low end, but it's perfectly normal for you.
Okay.
Then you have a genuine, but maybe moderate, epileptic seizure. 20 minutes later, in the ER, your count is 8,000. Now, 8,000 is still smack in the middle of that normal range. A busy doctor glances at that single number, sees 8,000, and their brain says, normal. No spite here.
But for that patient, that's a 100% increase. That's a doubling of their white blood cell count. That signifies a massive physiological event just took place.
Exactly. The significance of the spike is relative to the individual's baseline, not to some arbitrary population average. The authors estimate that as many as 89.5% of hospitalized patients after a GCS have some form of this elevation. But a huge number of them are missed because the final number doesn't cross that magic abnormal threshold.
So it's not about the absolute number, it's about the delta, the change.
It's all about the change, which of course is hard to know in an ER if you've never met the patient before. But it should definitely change how clinicians interpret those high normal values in anyone who's just had a seizure. A 9,000 might not be normal for them at all.
So just to recap where we are, we've established the spike is real. It's driven by adrenaline and lung mechanics. It correlates with seizure severity if you time it right, and it can be a useful diagnostic tool. But the authors of this paper, Vega and his team, they're not just trying to help doctors diagnose PNES. They are going after something much, much bigger.
This is where we get into the really critical part of the deep dive, the high stakes.
They believe this white blood cell count isn't just a generic severity meter. They think it's a severity meter for something very, very specific.
This is their central thesis, and it's a powerful one. They argue that because the white blood cells are coming from the lungs, the magnitude of the spike isn't just telling us how much the patient's arm and leg muscles convulsed. It's telling us what happened to their lungs during the seizure.
The leukocyte count is a mirror of respiratory compromise.
That's the idea. Remember, that whole marginated pool is sitting in the pulmonary vasculature. The only way to empty that pool so dramatically is to have massive violent changes in blood flow and pressure inside the lungs. It's a pulmonary event.
To illustrate this, they use an analogy of two different breathing maneuvers that sound complicated but are actually pretty simple, the Valsalva and the Mueller maneuvers.
Right. These are just fancy medical terms for things you've probably done without knowing it. The Valsalva maneuver is when you try to exhale forcefully against a closed airway. Think about when you're straining to lift a really heavy box, or when you hold your nose and blow to try and pop your ears on an airplane.
You're bearing down. You're increasing the pressure inside your chest.
Exactly. And the Mueller maneuver is the complete opposite. It's when you try to inhale against a closed airway. Imagine trying to suck really hard on a straw that's completely plugged. You're creating negative pressure inside your chest.
And just doing these things on their own can change your circulating white blood cell count.
They can. Not as dramatically as a seizure, but studies show they do. Because when you change the pressure in your chest, you change the diameter of those tiny capillaries in your lungs. You either squeeze them or you expand them, and that changes how many white blood cells get stuck or get released.
Okay, so let's apply this to a seizure. A patient having a convulsion isn't just shaking. They're often grunting, straining, gasping for air. Their airway might be blocked by their tongue, or their vocal cords might slam shut in a laryngeal spasm.
Precisely. They are essentially performing a series of violent, involuntary Valsalva and Mueller maneuvers over and over again. This creates massive, wild swings in the pressure inside their chest and lungs.
So now you've got this incredible combination of forces. You have the massive adrenaline surge causing the fire hose of blood flow.
And you have these huge pressure changes, physically squeezing and stretching the blood vessels in the lungs. That's a recipe for some serious mechanical stress on the lung tissue.
And that kind of stress can cause actual damage, can it?
It can. It leads us to a dangerous condition called neurogenic pulmonary edema, or NPE.
Neurogenic meaning it's caused by the brain.
Right. This is when fluid leaks from the blood vessels into the air sacs of the lungs. But it's not because of a heart problem, like in typical congestive heart failure. It's because of a direct injury or event in the central nervous system, like a traumatic brain injury or, in this case, a massive seizure.
How does that happen?
That same massive adrenaline surge constricts blood vessels all over the body, which dramatically increases the pressure in the pulmonary circulation. The pressure gets so high that it physically damages the delicate barrier between the blood vessels and the air sacs. It becomes leaky, and fluid floods into the lungs.
The patient is essentially drowning from the inside out because of the seizure.
It's a very dangerous complication. And the authors point out a critical correlation. Studies show that high post-seizure leukocyte counts often coexist with signs of this neurogenic pulmonary edema.
Because they're both caused by the same underlying mechanism.
Exactly. The same explosive shear force and pressure that rips the white blood cells off the vessel walls is the same force that damages the barrier and lets fluid leak out. They're two sides of the same coin.
So, if an ER doctor sees a patient with a white count of, say, 28,000 after a seizure, they shouldn't just be thinking, not an infection. They should be thinking,
what happened to this person's lungs? I need to listen to their chest very carefully. I need to check their oxygen saturation. I might even need a chest x-ray. The white count becomes a red flag for pulmonary injury.
And this leads us directly to the darkest, most feared topic in all of epilepsy, but one we absolutely have to talk about, CDEP.
Sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. It's the leading cause of epilepsy-related mortality, and it's just devastating. You have a person, often young and otherwise healthy, who has epilepsy. They have a seizure, very often in their sleep, and they're simply found dead the next morning. And for the longest time, we had no idea why it happened.
The autopsy would come back normal.
Frustratingly normal.
Yeah.
But the research over the last decade or so is pointing more and more towards a cascade of events that leads to terminal respiratory and cardiac failure.
It's what the people calls the perfect storm.
It is. The storm starts with a generalized convulsive seizure. That's the trigger. Then, during and immediately after the seizure, you get severe respiratory aberrations. This could be central apnea, where the brain just stops sending the signal to breathe. It could be an obstructed airway. It could be that laryngospasm we mentioned.
So their breathing is already compromised.
Severely compromised. And then you add a third fascinating element to the mix, something called the mammalian diving response.
Wait, the diving response, as in seals and whales and dolphins?
And us.
Yeah.
Humans have it too. It's an ancient hardwired reflex. If you plunge your face into cold water, or more importantly here, if your body is deprived of oxygen, this reflex kicks in to try and save the brain and heart at all costs.
How does it do that?
It causes profound changes in your circulation. It dramatically slows your heart rate, and it shunts all the blood away from your limbs and extremities and forces it into your central circulation to the heart, lungs, and brain. It's a last-ditch survival mechanism.
But in the context of a seizure, where the lungs are already under immense pressure,
it's catastrophic. You're forcing a massive volume of blood into a pulmonary system that is already under siege. The pressure just goes to an unsustainable level.
Okay, let's connect all the dots here. Let's walk through the author's hypothesis.
The seizure triggers this perfect physiological storm. The lungs are being battered by adrenaline-fueled shear force and massive pressure swings. This violent event is flushing white blood cells out of the marginated pool in huge numbers.
And if that respiratory stress goes too far, if the breathing doesn't restart properly, if the diving reflex puts too much strain on the heart,
you get a fatal cascade. Respiratory collapse, cardiac arrest, SUDP.
So the author's central hypothesis is?
The hypothesis is that a massive post-convulsive leukocyte elevation, that huge spike in the white count, is a direct biomarker for the severity of that respiratory distress. It is a quantifiable sign that the patient just survived a near-fatal vent inside their own lungs.
It's like the Richter scale for the seizure's impact on the respiratory system.
A perfect way to put it. If the white blood cell count is sky high, it means the respiratory trauma was severe. And if the respiratory trauma was severe, the authors argue, that patient may be at a much higher risk for SUDP in the future.
It's a warning sign. We might be missing this critical warning sign. A patient comes into the ER, they have that huge count, we rule out infection, and we send them home a day later.
We might be sending home someone whose lungs just took a massive, invisible beating. Someone who is at risk of not recovering their breathing properly after the next seizure.
So is there any direct data on this? Do we have white blood cell counts from people who have died of CGD?
That's the tragic missing piece of the puzzle. Usually by the time a CGD victim is found, it's hours later. It's too late for blood work, and it's not something a standard autopsy would necessarily look for. But the paper mentions one absolutely chilling case. It was a near CGD patient.
What does that mean, near CGD?
It was a child who had a seizure, went into complete respiratory and cardiac arrest, was found, and was successfully resuscitated. A true save from the brink of death.
Okay. And they got blood work.
They got blood work on arrival at the hospital.
What was the white blood cell count?
32,000.
Wow, 32,000. Normal tops out at 11,000.
Right. 32,000 is the number you might see in someone with advanced leukemia or a life-threatening full-body infection. It suggests an absolutely incredible amount of sheer force and trauma occurred in that child's lungs during the event. It's a single data point, an N of one, but it's a powerful piece of support for the hypothesis.
This completely reframes how we should look at that routine blood test. It's not just a binary check for bacteria anymore. It's a granular record of the violence of the seizure.
It's a severity meter, and the author suggests we should start using it that way for risk stratification. Instead of ignoring that high count, we should see it as a major red flag. This patient just survived a major respiratory event. They need closer monitoring. Maybe they need a sleep study to look for nighttime breathing issues. Maybe they need a referral to a specialized epilepsy center.
The paper also suggests some really clever future directions for research. One of them involves looking at the lung tissue itself in autopsies.
This idea is so elegant. If the hypothesis is correct, that a massive seizure sweeps the marginated pool completely empty, then if you were to look at a microscope slide of the lung tissue of someone who died of CDP immediately following a seizure, what should you see?
The parking lot should be empty.
The alveolar capillaries should be eerily depleted of neutrophils because they were all violently flushed out into the bloodstream just before death. If pathologists started specifically looking for this depleted marginated pool in suspected CDP cases, it could become a new histological clue, a way to confirm the diagnosis from the tissue itself.
That's brilliant. You're looking for the absence of something to prove the presence of a massive pre-death event.
It's really a beautiful scientific idea. And it brings us right back to the title of the paper, Hiding in Plain Sight. The potential answer to reducing SUDEEP risk isn't necessarily in some new billion-dollar genetic test or a fancy new brain scan. It's in the standard CBC, the complete blood count test. It costs a few dollars and is run millions of times a day in every hospital in the world.
It's just staggering to think about. The data has been there since 1896. Joseph Capp saw the pattern. He didn't know about the marginated pool. He didn't know about sheer force or the mammalian diving reflex. But he saw that severity mattered.
And for 120 years, we've charted it and moved on. We got completely distracted by the infection red herring. We let our assumption, high WBC equals infection, blind us to the much more interesting and potentially life-saving physiological story.
So let's distill this for everyone listening. If you're a clinician, the takeaway is pretty clear. Look at that post-seizure WBC count with new eyes. But for the rest of us, what's the broader lesson here?
I think it's a profound lesson in curiosity and in not taking routine data for granted. It's a reminder that the human body is this intricate mechanical and electrical system. Everything is connected. An electrical storm in the brain causes a traffic jam in the lungs to clear out, which changes a number on a blood test drawn from the arm. We can't view these organ systems in isolation.
And it's a powerful reminder that normal is relative. A number that looks normal on a chart might be a sign of a seismic event for that specific individual.
Absolutely. Context is everything.
Okay. To wrap this incredible story up, let's just hammer home the key takeaways for everyone one last time.
I'd say there are five big ones. One, a major seizure mimics the body's fight or flight response, causing a massive adrenaline dump.
Two, that adrenaline makes the heart pound, sending blood rushing through the lungs with incredible force.
Three, that rushing blood physically sweeps a huge hidden army of white blood cells that were parked in the lungs out into the main circulation.
Four, this is absolutely not an infection. It's a rapid mechanical redistribution of cells.
And five, and this is the most important one, the size of that spike is a direct reflection of the violence of that event in the lungs. It's a measure of the respiratory stress the patient just endured.
And because of that, it might be our best, cheapest, and most overlooked warning sign for future SUD risk.
It might just be the clue that saves a life if we finally start paying attention to it correctly.
It's just incredible stuff. And I want to leave everyone listening with a final thought to chew on. We spend billions of dollars on medical research. We're developing incredible AI diagnostic tools and personalized genomic sequencing. Yeah. And those are all fantastic, vital things. But this paper is a humbling reminder that we are still sitting on mountains of data from simple routine tests that we've been running for over a century.
It really begs the question, what else are we ignoring?
Exactly. If a simple blood test from 1896 holds a potential key to understanding and preventing the most mysterious and fatal complication of epilepsy, what other routine numbers are we glancing at every day, checking off as normal and filing away simply because we think we already know what they mean?
That's the question that should keep every curious doctor and scientist up at night.
And hopefully it's a question that keeps you curious too. Look deeper at the routine. You never know what's hiding in plain sight. Thanks for diving in with us.
A pleasure as always.